stranded in the middle of nowhere, trapped with people you thought you could trust, and somewhere in the room, something is watching, waiting, and ready to rip you apart from the inside out. This is The Thing, a movie about paranoia, survival, and the worst game of guess who ever played. Let's get into it.
Just discovered something. For 100,000 years, it was buried in the snow and ice. Now it has found a place to live. Inside. Where no one can see it. Or hear it. Or feel it.
I know I'm human. Some of you are still human. This thing doesn't want to show itself. It wants to hide inside an imitation. It'll fight if it has to. But it's vulnerable out in the open. If it takes us over, then it has no more enemies. Nobody left to kill it. And then it's won.
You guys gonna listen to Gary? He can beat one of those things!
Look, I'm just saying, a flamethrower solves a lot of problems real fast.
A flamethrower. You know, to be fair, is a pretty good way to solve any problem.
But what if we're wrong? What if we torch someone who's not the thing?
Then we apologize and move on.
You're the real villain here, aren't you?
That's not important. What is important is that this is The Thing. John Carpenter's masterclass in paranoia, body horror, and bad workplace relationships.
Also known as what happens when you don't believe in HR.
Let's get into it. All right, before we dive headfirst into paranoia, body horror, and the most stressful blood test in cinematic history, let's introduce the crew trapped in this metaphorical Antarctic research station with me. First up, we got the guy who's seen this movie 100 times, has probably overanalyzed every frame, and is 100% convinced I'm the thing already. Jeff.
I mean, I'm not convinced. I'm just keeping my flamethrower ready.
Fair, fair. And over here, we've got a man who just saw this movie for the first time, experienced sheer existential terror alone, and is now deeply suspicious of his own pets. Our very own producer, Steve.
Listen, man, I don't care how cute my dog looks. I am not taking any chances. The second she starts acting weird, torching the whole house.
Classic overreaction.
Oh, really, Jeff? That's interesting, coming from a guy who just said he has a flamethrower ready for Adam.
Okay. Let's get into it. Before this devolves into an actual flamethrower standoff. All right, let's get this out of the way right now. Which one of you is the thing?
I don't know. Which one of us suggested we cover this movie?
Oh, it's Adam. 100%. He's the one always pushing for movies where everyone dies at the end.
Look, I just think it's the perfect movie to cover. But if I was the thing, you wouldn't even know until it was too late.
That's exactly what the thing would say.
Okay, now I'm nervous.
Good. That means the thing is working. Okay, before we get into how this masterpiece got made, What was your first reaction to The Thing?
Oh, I've loved this movie since the first time I saw it. It's just perfect. The paranoia, the practical effects, the fact that every time you rewatch it, you notice something new.
Yeah. I'd somehow never seen this before, and I have to ask, why did you guys let me watch this alone?
Wait, you went in totally blind?
Yes. And let me tell you, I was not ready. I thought I was watching a regular monster movie. You know, some guys in Antarctica, weird alien stuff, whatever. Then that first dog transformation happened and my soul left my body.
That's the moment you realize this is not a normal horror movie.
Yeah. The Thing isn't just scary, it's deeply unsettling. Like, I finished it and immediately started questioning if I could trust my own pets.
That's how you know it worked. It burrows into your brain. And I bet you'll never watch it the same way again.
What's amazing about The Thing is that it's not just a monster movie. It's a psychological horror film first. It's not about what The Thing is. It's about how people react when they realize the enemy could be standing right next to them. It's not even about survival. It's about whether anyone can even prove they're human.
Yeah. There's no hero moment, no real victory. Even Alien has Ripley blowing the xenomorph out the airlock and escaping. Here, it just ends, and you're left uncomfortable.
And I love that, because unlike most horror movies, The Thing gets scarier the more you think about it.
All right, I have to ask, where do you guys rank The Thing in terms of horror movies?
Top five, easily. Probably the best science fiction horror ever made.
I mean, I might need therapy after watching it, so it's definitely effective.
For me, this is top three horror of all time. It's better than Alien in some ways.
Oh, that's bold.
Look, Alien is phenomenal, but it still has rules. The xenomorph behaves in predictable ways. In The Thing, there are no rules. You never know when or how it'll strike.
Yeah, I was constantly on edge, and I love that the paranoia starts before anything even happens.
Exactly. The Norwegian guys at the beginning, they're the only ones who know what's really going on, but they don't speak English, so they get shot before they can explain anything.
And then you realize they weren't crazy. They were right.
All right. We all agree it's a horror masterpiece, but what's crazy is that when it came out, it bombed. Critics hated it. Audiences weren't ready.
Yeah, and it nearly wrecked John Carpenter's career.
Wait, what?
Yep. And the wildest part? He almost didn't even make it. We're going to get into why Carpenter chose The Thing after Escape from New York, and why it was almost directed by someone else.
All right, so let's talk about why John Carpenter chose to make The Thing after Escape from New York. And let's be clear, this was a big deal for him.
Right, because Escape from New York was a massive hit. It made like $50 million on a small budget. That's like pulling off a heist and getting away with it.
And Carpenter could have played it safe. He could have just made a sequel and called it a day.
Yeah. Universal actually wanted him to do Halloween 2, but he refused because he didn't want to repeat himself. Instead, he signed on with Universal for his first ever studio-backed movie, which was The Thing.
Which is insane when you think about it. Dude went from independent filmmaker king to, here's a giant studio budget. Go crazy.
So wait, did Universal approach him for The Thing, or did he chase it down?
So, funny enough, Carpenter was a huge fan of The Thing from Another World from 1951, the first movie adaptation. He even referenced it in Halloween. The kids are watching it on TV.
Okay, that is wild. The man basically teased his future job in a different movie.
It's like if James Gunn threw a random Superman reference into Guardians of the Galaxy and now he's actually directing Superman.
Exactly. But here's the thing. Carpenter didn't want to touch it at first.
Wait, what?
Yeah, he said he respected the original too much and didn't think he could do it better. He loved Howard Hawks, who produced the 1951 version.
Okay, that's like being offered to remake Jaws and saying, so, nah, I don't want to mess with Spielberg.
Exactly. But here's what changed his mind. His friend and producer, Stuart Cohen, told him, forget the 50s version. Go back to the original novella.
Which is called Who Goes There? And it's way more horrifying than the 1951 movie.
Yeah, the 1951 film just had a big Frankenstein-looking monster. But the novella, it had a shape-shifting, body-stealing nightmare alien.
So Carpenter reads this and is like, oh, now we're talking.
Exactly. The thing in the book was an imitator, a creature that could perfectly copy anyone. That's what hooked him.
So instead of a big monster stomping around, we got a sci-fi horror hood unit where everyone's paranoid and turning into meat sculptures.
Which, honestly, is way scarier than some guy in a rubber suit.
Now, there was one specific scene that completely sold Carpenter on doing the thing, the blood test scene.
Oh, now this I understand.
The best scene in the movie, hands down.
Yeah, that wasn't in the 1951 film, but it was in the original novella. Carpenter read it and immediately went, okay, I have to make this movie.
Because it's the ultimate paranoia moment. It's literally a bunch of guys sitting around going, one of us isn't human. Let's find out who, you know.
And instead of just asking questions, they're like, let's heat up a piece of metal and stab our own blood.
And Carpenter saw the potential for absolute chaos.
Which he delivered perfectly. Because when that blood jumps, you jump.
I don't care how many times I see it, it still gets me.
And Carpenter knew that was his movie. He wanted to make a film where people didn't trust each other and where the audience couldn't relax, because anything could happen at any time.
Okay, but Carpenter wasn't just making this because he wanted to. He was finally working with a big Hollywood studio.
Right, this wasn't an indie film. This was Universal Pictures.
Exactly. Carpenter had been scraping by on low budgets, and now Universal was like, here's $15 million. Make something huge.
And he did not waste that money.
Nope. He spent it on groundbreaking practical effects, freezing locations in British Columbia, and Kurt Russell's beard.
Hold up. How much of that budget do we think went to the beard?
Listen, that beard is immaculate. You don't get that kind of grizzled survivalist look overnight.
Honestly, worth every penny. So when you really think about it, Carpenter making the thing makes perfect sense. Halloween was a paranoia movie. Who's the killer? Where is he? Escape from New York was a siege movie, isolated, cut off from the world. The Thing combined both, its paranoia and isolation cranked to 11.
It's literally the ultimate John Carpenter movie. Tough guys trapped together, an unstoppable, shape-shifting enemy, flamethrowers.
If that's not a John Carpenter movie, I don't know what is.
So now that we know why Carpenter made The Thing, let's talk about how the hell they pulled it off.
Oh, you mean freezing their asses off in Alaska? The insane creature effects? Wilford Brimley going completely feral?
And the studio slowly realizing they had no idea what kind of horror movie they signed up for.
Yep. Next up, we go behind the scenes and break down how they made one of the most terrifying movies of all time. All right, so let's get into the casting and production of The Thing, because honestly, this cast is perfect.
It's all dudes being dudes, but in the most terrifying way possible.
And nobody trusts anybody.
Exactly. Carpenter wanted an all-male ensemble to reflect the isolated nature of an Antarctic research team. No one is posturing. No one is trying to impress a love interest. It feels raw and real.
Yeah, because if they had cast like Jamie Lee Curtis in this, you know she'd be the final girl.
Right. But in The Thing, there is no final girl. There's barely even a final guy.
Now, Kurt Russell was not locked in as MacReady from the start.
Wait, hold on. You're telling me they almost didn't cast the most majestic beard in cinema history?
It's true. Universal had other names in mind for MacReady. Christopher Walken, Jeff Bridges, Nick Nolte, even Sam Shepard.
Christopher Walken as MacReady?
Listen, guys, I think someone here is not who they say they are.
Yeah, I think we dodged a bullet there. Ultimately, Russell wasn't even cast until the last minute, and that's a terrible walking.
Oh yeah, I gotta say, I dig the beard.
It's an all-time great movie beard. And fun fact, Russell actually grew it out for an entire year, just in case Carpenter needed him for the role.
That is dedication right there.
Dude was walking around Hollywood for a year, looking like he already survived the events of The Thing.
It's a survival beard. You look at MacReady and think, this guy is either going to save us or kill us all just to be sure.
And I respect that.
It's got volume. It's got shape. It's perfectly scruffy but controlled. This is powerful facial hair.
Yeah, it's the kind of beard where you just instinctively trust the guy and also think he might stab you.
Which is exactly the energy MacReady needs in this movie. For Childs, they had a lot of options. Carl Weathers, Bernie Casey, even Isaac Hayes. Ernie Hudson was actually the front runner.
Wait! Ghostbusters Ernie Hudson?
Yep. But then they saw Keith David, a New York stage actor who had never done a movie like this before.
And he killed it.
He did. But get this, he broke his hand in a car accident right before filming started.
Hold up. What?
Yeah. First day on set, he shows up with his hand completely messed up, so Carpenter made him wear a black glove to hide the cast.
Wait, did the thing infect his hand first?
All right. We need to take a moment and appreciate Keith freaking David.
Oh, absolutely.
This man walked into his first big movie role and absolutely owned it.
Right? He comes in with zero film experience and somehow ends up being the coolest guy in the movie.
And this is a cast full of grizzled dudes who look like they've been punched in the face by life.
Yeah, but Keith David still steals every scene he's in.
First off, the voice.
That man's voice was already legendary, and this was his first major film.
Right? His voice sounds like it was aged in an oak barrel for 40 years.
You gotta be fucking kidding. Yours sounds like it's been soaking for 20 years, Jeff.
Ha ha ha! Oh my god, chill.
What? Steve? And then you have MacReady's body language. He doesn't even have to say anything. He just looks at you and you feel the intensity.
And then, not to get too far ahead, of course, the last scene of the movie is just him and Kurt Russell staring each other down.
No action, no big effects. Just two guys sitting in the snow, waiting to see who blinks first.
And Keith David makes it so unsettling.
Because you don't know if he's the thing or not.
And Keith David plays it just right. He's not acting suspicious, but he's also not acting completely normal.
And the way he delivers that final line...
Why don't we just wait here for a little while, see what happens?
Perfection. At the end of the day, the thing wouldn't be the same without Keith David as Childs.
Absolutely. He's the perfect foil to Kurt Russell. He brings tension, attitude, and just enough mystery to make that final scene legendary.
And that's why we appreciate the hell out of Keith David.
And if he ever listens to this, Keith David, we love you. Please narrate our lives.
Okay, before we move on, The Thing is obviously one of the greatest horror movies ever. But would you also say it's one of the greatest snow movies?
Steve, where are you going with this?
I don't know. I was just thinking... It's a great trapped-in-one-location movie, but it's also a great stuck-in-the-snow movie. Like, where does it rank?
Ooh, that's a solid question. Because if we're talking about great snow movies, you have to include The Thing, but also stuff like The Shining, Fargo, Cliffhanger.
Oh, God. We're doing this now. We're doing this now.
We have to, because if we don't settle this, someone else will...
Ha ha. Okay, obviously, The Thing is top tier because it's not just snowy and miserable, but it's also completely hopeless. Like, you feel the cold in your bones.
Yeah, no cozy winter vibes here. Just death and ice and suffering.
All right, but where does it rank against The Shining? because that's also a terrifying stuck-in-the-snow horror movie.
Okay, but The Shining is mostly about cabin fever and ghosts. It's not like Jack Nicholson had to worry about his coworkers turning into grotesque meat sculptures.
He kind of did, though. They were all creepy ghost hallucinations telling him to murder his family.
Yeah, but the thing is different. The snow matters more. Like, if they weren't in Antarctica, no problem. They'd just call the cops and be fine. But in The Shining, Jack was already crazy before the snow showed up.
Oh, that's a great point. The snow in The Thing is a plot device. In The Shining, it's mostly set dressing.
Wait, so does that mean we're ruling out Empire Strikes Back? Because Hoth is a top-tier snow setting.
Ha ha ha.
Oh my god. Okay. Hoth doesn't count.
Excuse me?
Ha ha ha. Oh, here we go. I knew this was going to start a fight.
How does Hoth not count? It's all snow. They literally have snow monsters, snow speeders, snow trenches.
Because Hoth is just the backdrop for the opening scene. It's not a snow movie. It's a movie that happens to start in the snow.
Jeff, buddy, that is some real gatekeeping energy you're bringing to this. Real gatekeeping energy.
Yeah, Jeff. Who made you the snow movie commissioner?
You cannot tell me Empire Strikes Back is a snow movie. You can't. I won't allow it.
All right. New question. Since we're talking about trapped in one location movies, and we're already completely off topic, where does this rank in Everyone is Screwed movies?
Oh, now this is a list I need.
We're never getting to the effects segment, are we?
Okay, so you got The Thing, Alien, Green Room, Assault on Precinct 13, The Hateful Eight.
Oh, The Mist. That one is all time doomed, and I'm glad you stopped confusing Green Room with Green Book.
Oh, shit.
Ha ha ha!
All right, can we please get back to The Thing now?
We've been talking about The Thing the entire time. We just took the scenic route.
Yeah, Jeff, it's all connected. Snow movies, isolation movies, doomed movies, Hoth. It all makes sense.
This is why I drink. All right, so that was a 5 minutes of absolute nonsense. Let's refocus.
To be fair, most of that was technically related to The Thing.
Yeah, if you squint, it's all about isolation, cold, paranoia, whether or not Jeff is a snow movie gatekeeper.
You two are going to give me an aneurysm.
Jeff, buddy, we are professionals. We got this. We're totally back on track now.
Okay, good. Because we still need to talk about the practical effects and...
Does The Hateful Eight count as a snow movie?
Oh, see, now that's interesting.
No more. We are moving on, right now.
Okay, we're done, for real this time.
We would never intentionally derail the show, Jeff.
Okay, special effects, Rob, Botten, let's go.
See, that wasn't so hard.
But seriously, Hateful Eight?
Okay, I know this is going to open a whole can of worms that will derail this podcast, but I have to ask. How fast did Wilford Brimley go from zero to full-on crazy in this movie? Because I swear it felt like 30 seconds.
Oh, immediate. No hesitation. One glance at a computer screen and boom, apocalypse mode.
He goes from mildly concerned scientist to destroy all communications, kill all dogs in record time.
I was expecting at least, like, a build-up. A few, something's not right moments, but nope. This man sees one janky 1982 simulation and instantly decides the only way out is murder.
Yeah, he doesn't even attempt to explain himself, just blam. He shoots the radio, tips over a desk, and starts swinging like he just found out his grandkids don't eat oatmeal.
I love that nobody even tries to stop him at first. They just kind of stand there like, Blair? Buddy? You good? And he's already axing the mainframe.
By the time anyone reacts, he's full shining mode. Like, how do you go from, hey guys, we should be careful, to, I must kill everyone in this room with no in between?
You know he was already at, like, 90% stress level when the movie started. The alien just pushed him over the edge.
Yeah, this dude did not need much of a nudge. I feel like before the thing even showed up, he was already 2 bad days away from going ham on that outpost.
And then when they finally lock him up, he's just sitting there like a guilty dog after getting caught tearing up the furniture. He's like, hey, fellas, I'm fine now. You can let me out.
No, sir. You destroyed the radio. You tried to shoot everyone. You are staying in the murder shack.
I'm better now, guys. I swear, I just want to come inside and not kill you all.
The absolute audacity of this man to go full psycho and then act like he should be forgiven 5 minutes later.
Yeah, sorry, Brimley. You don't get a my bad on this one.
Wait, is this the only time we're ever going to cover Wilford Brimley? Because it's not like we're going to do Cocoon, right? Because then I'd actually have to watch it.
Steve, are you seriously asking if we're going to do a deep dive episode on the heartwarming sci-fi movie about Steve Guttenberg and his magically rejuvenated elderly best friends?
Okay, so I haven't seen it. I just know Guttenberg is there for some reason, and for some reason he's friends with all these old people. Why? And also, weren't they weirdly horny?
Oh, extremely horny. They go full, we've got our groove back, let's do this mode. Aliens make them young on the inside, and they immediately decide it's time to party.
What does that mean? Why did you say it like that?
Because the whole thing is, what if your grandparents got superpowers and then immediately used them for seduction?
Why? Why did they make a second one?
Because the first one made money, Steve. That's how sequels happen. That's why we have 3 Crocodile Dundee movies.
No, but who wanted more? Who finished Cocoon and said, you know what this needed? A sequel where the old people come back and, oh my god, I can't even finish that sentence.
We are never doing Cocoon.
Good, because I am not sitting through 2 movies about aliens giving senior citizens cosmic sex powers.
Moving on.
Wait, is this the only time we're ever going to cover Wilford Brimley? Because it's not like we're going to do Cocoon, right? Because then I'd actually have to watch it.
Steve, are you seriously asking if we're going to do a deep dive episode on the heartwarming sci-fi movie about Steve Guttenberg and his magically rejuvenated elderly best friends?
Okay, so I haven't seen it. I just know Guttenberg is there for some reason, and for some reason he's friends with all these old people. Why? And also, weren't they weirdly horny?
Oh, extremely horny. They go full, we've got our groove back, let's do this mode. Aliens make them young on the inside, and they immediately decide it's time to party.
What does that mean? Why did you say it like that?
Because the whole thing is, what if your grandparents got superpowers and then immediately used them for seduction?
Why? Why did they make a second one?
Because the first one made money, Steve. That's how sequels happen. That's why we have 3 Crocodile Dundee movies.
No, but who wanted more? Who finished Cocoon and said, you know what this needed? A sequel where the old people come back and, oh my god, I can't even finish that sentence.
We are never doing Cocoon.
Good, because I am not sitting through 2 movies about aliens giving senior citizens cosmic sex powers.
Moving on.
After these messages, we'll be right back.
All right, now we get to what truly sets the thing apart from every other horror movie, the practical effects. And we need to talk about the mad genius responsible for it all, Rob Bottin.
A 22-year-old lunatic who basically gave himself a near-death experience just to make sure the thing looked as horrifying as possible.
Wait, hold on. You're telling me a kid in his early 20s was given full control over the most ambitious monster effects ever attempted?
Yep, and he didn't sleep for over a year.
Dude literally worked himself into the hospital. Not figuratively, he was hospitalized for exhaustion, a bleeding ulcer, double pneumonia.
That is not normal.
Nope. But that's how committed he was. He was living at the studio, sleeping under workbenches, and his whole life was just, make the monster more horrifying.
Rob, buddy, please. You made a guy's head turn into a spider. You won horror. Go home. Sleep. Eat something that isn't covered in latex.
How was nobody like, hey, maybe let's not let the effects guy die on set?
Well, they did, because eventually Stan Winston had to step in and help. So the first big transformation scene, where the husky mutates in the kennel, Botten was so overwhelmed with other effects that he called in Stan Winston, yes, the guy who later did Aliens and Jurassic Park.
Oh, so Botten did ask for help?
Barely. He basically told Winston, do the dog scene, but don't take credit.
And Winston respected him so much that he actually refused to be credited. He told Botten, this is your movie. You deserve the credit.
That's awesome.
And you know what? That dog transformation scene still makes me want to leave the room.
All right, let's talk about the scene that made audiences lose their damn minds, the chess chomp.
Oh, God.
An absolute nightmare of a moment.
So, in the movie, Norris collapses and Dr. Copper tries to revive him with a defibrillator.
And then his chest turns into a giant mouth and bites the dude's arms off.
It's beautifully disgusting.
Here's how they did it. They cast an actor who was a double amputee to play Copper in that moment. They gave him fake prosthetic arms filled with rubber veins, wax bones, and jello. He slams the defibrillator down, and the chest jaws clamp shut, severing the fake arms. Cut to blood spraying, total chaos, and everyone in the theater screaming.
Okay, that is genius.
Yeah, zero CGI, just practical wizardry.
And it's so well done that even today, audiences react the same way they did in 1982. Absolute shock. But that's not even the worst part. The real moment that made audiences lose their collective sanity?
The head spider.
Oh, you mean when Norris's head detaches from his body, grows spider legs, and starts crawling away like a Lovecraftian nightmare?
Yep, that effect involved. A mechanical stretching skin effect for when the head pulls away. A prosthetic head filled with fake goo and muscle fibers. A radio-controlled head with articulated spider legs operated by puppeteers lying on the floor.
How did they even come up with that?
Botten was hallucinating from exhaustion at that point. So I assume the ideas just came to him in fever dreams.
Now, fun fact. One of the creature effects literally caught fire on set.
Wait, what?
Yeah. One of the models had flammable foam inside, and when they used a flame bar for lighting, it ignited and nearly destroyed the entire creature.
That would have been the worst way for this movie to get delayed.
Sorry, guys, we can't finish the movie because the monster actually self-destructed.
Here's the crazy thing. The thing's effects still look better than most modern CGI.
Because they're real. Your brain knows when something is actually there versus when it's just pixels on a screen.
Yeah, even when the effects are gross and weird, they feel tangible.
And they use smart cinematography. Dim lighting, quick cuts, just enough visibility to make it terrifying. The worst part? Rob Botten didn't even get an Oscar nomination.
What?
Yep, the most groundbreaking practical effects ever created, and the Academy was like, nah, we're good.
And guess what won Best Visual Effects in 1982?
Please don't say E.T.
It was E.T.
Oh, you mean the rubber puppet that just stands there?
All right, we covered the special effects. We talked about how Rob Botten nearly died for this movie. Now, we're going to move on to...
Wait, before we do, I just thought of something...
Oh, no. No. Steve, no, we are not doing this again.
Ooh, what is it?
If the thing was real, and you had to spend a winter in an isolated station with a group of celebrities, who would you trust?
Oh, hell yes. This is a great question.
Why do you do this to me? We were so close to moving on.
Jeff, this is important. This could save lives.
Okay. You get 5 people to survive with you in Antarctica. They have to be famous. Go.
I refuse to participate.
What? Jeff, are you just going to die in the snow out of spite?
That is a very Jeff thing to do.
Fine, I'll play. But if this derails for another 20 minutes, I am setting the station on fire myself.
All right. Number one, if we're talking about survival strategy and someone who will 100% kill the thing before it even has a chance, Keanu freaking Reeves.
Yes, no hesitation. He wouldn't even be paranoid. He'd just instinctively know who was infected and handle it John Wick style.
Okay, that's a good pick.
See? Now you're playing the game. Okay. Next, Sigourney Weaver. If Alien has taught me anything, it's that she does not tolerate bullshit from extraterrestrial threats.
Sigourney would be in charge. She'd have the plan. If Keanu is our thing killer, she's our leader.
All right, yeah. That's a solid team so far.
Now, we need a wild card. Someone who can throw the thing off. Someone who would either completely break under pressure or become more powerful than ever. And for that, I am drafting Nicolas Cage.
What?
Oh my God. Yes.
Think about it, Jeff. The thing would be terrified of him. Cage would start acting weirder than the creature itself. No one would know what the hell is going on. It wouldn't even want to assimilate him because it wouldn't be able to match his energy.
The thing would look at him and go, "Nope, never mind."
I hate that this makes sense.
All right, fourth pick, Samuel L. Jackson. Because if the thing even tried to take him out, you know he'd go full monologue mode.
I have had it with these motherfucking shapeshifters in this motherfucking outpost.
I mean, you're not wrong.
And the final pick, Weird Al Yankovic.
What?
I did not see that coming, but I respect it.
You need one guy who keeps morale up, one guy who reminds you why you're fighting. And tell me right now, who on earth would be better at that than Weird Al?
Okay, that's it. I quit. We were so close to moving on. And you picked Weird Al. I'm done.
Give it up for Adam, everybody. 2025 Antarctic Survival Draft Champion.
We are never finishing this episode. Wait, Adam, you didn't pick Kurt Russell for your Survive the Thing celebrity team?
Oh, my God, you didn't. You really didn't.
Wait, what?
We just spent countless minutes building a Who Survives the Thing dream team, and you didn't pick Kurt, freaking, Russell.
Not MacReady. Not the man who actually survived the thing.
I need you to explain yourself right now.
I mean, I thought it was implied.
No, that doesn't count. You picked Weird Al Yankovic, but not MacReady?
I can't even process this. I'm having a stroke.
Adam, you picked Nicolas Cage, but not Kurt Russell.
Correct.
You picked Weird Al and Nicolas Cage, but not the actual lead of the thing.
Yes, because I'm playing chess. You guys are playing checkers.
What the hell does that even mean?
Adam, explain yourself. Right now.
Okay. First of all, MacReady dies, or at the very least, he's probably dead by the end of the movie. That's not ideal for a survival squad.
But it's Kurt Russell.
Yeah, the man survived this movie and escaped from New York and Big Trouble in Little China, and he went toe-to-toe with a psychotic Santa Claus in the Christmas Chronicles.
Yeah, but listen, if we're doing a celebrity team, I don't just want survival. I want chaos. I want fear factor. I want the thing to look at our group and say, "Nope, I'm out."
So, Nicolas Cage made your list, but not Kurt Russell.
Yes, because Cage would confuse the hell out of the thing. The beard alone wouldn't save Kurt. Cage's unhinged energy? That's a deterrent.
The thing would be like, "This man is too unstable. He's one of us."
I don't even know who you are anymore.
You're not supposed to.
Fine, whatever. We're moving on. We're talking about why this masterpiece flopped. Let's go. All right. So we've talked about how The Thing is a technical masterpiece, a casting masterclass, and one of the best paranoia horror movies ever made.
And yet when it hit theaters in 1982, it tanked.
I still don't get it. How?
Well, part of it was timing. Because The Thing didn't just release at any time. It came out during one of the greatest summers for movies in history.
The summer of 1982 was stacked. Like, unfairly stacked.
Let's just look at the competition The Thing had to go up against in the same month. June 4th, 1982. Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan.
One of the greatest movies ever made.
June 11th, 1982. A little movie called E.T. The Extraterrestrial. June 18th, 1982. Blade Runner and The Thing.
Pop. Oh, come on. The same day? That's like box office cannibalism.
That is brutal. That's like releasing your weird indie horror movie the same weekend as Avengers Endgame.
I don't know. More people probably would have seen the little indie horror movie than, say, a DC superhero movie that weekend, which is what this scenario feels like.
Right? And out of all of those movies, guess which one completely dominated everything?
E.T.?
Yep.
Okay, but just to be clear, everyone likes E.T., right?
Wait, Jeff? Are you about to say some shit about E.T. right now?
I mean, it's fine. It's just a little schmaltzy.
Excuse me. E.T. is schmaltzy? It's one of the most beloved movies of all time.
I didn't say it was bad. I just said it's sentimental as hell. The swelling John Williams score. The tearjerker moments. The way it's so obviously trying to make you cry.
Oh, this is beautiful. Jeff hates emotions.
I don't hate emotions. I just don't like being emotionally manipulated by a glowing space potato.
How dare you?
Ha ha! Look at what you've done, Jeff. You broke Steve's childhood. Somewhere John Williams just felt that insult.
Oh, come on. It's so obvious what Spielberg was doing. E.T. is a scientific formula designed to make audiences cry on cue. It's too clean, too perfect. It's like eating a McDonald's Happy Meal for your feelings.
Wow, I thought I knew you, but this?
Steve, buddy, do you want to kill him, or should I?
All right, fine. It's a well-made movie. It's just not for me. Happy?
I'll allow it, barely.
Okay, but real talk. If we ever cover E.T., can we only talk about the government guys in hazmat suits showing up like they're storming Normandy?
Oh, now I'm interested.
You guys are monsters. Absolute monsters.
So, The Thing didn't just fail in 1982. It got buried. It didn't even have a chance. The critics hated it. Audiences ignored it. And it wasn't until years later that people started to realize, oh, wait, this is one of the best horror movies ever made. It did a reverse Shawshank.
Hold on, what the hell is a reverse Shawshank?
Okay, The Shawshank Redemption came out in 1994, and when it hit theaters, nobody cared. It barely made any money. Critics liked it, but it got ignored. It was just a sad little prison movie that came and went.
A forgotten relic, lost to time.
But then something magical happened. It got on cable TV and started playing constantly. Like TNT and TBS played it so much that it just ingrained itself into the culture. People who never saw it in theaters watched it at home, fell in love with it, and suddenly, years later, it was being called one of the greatest movies ever made. Shawshank went from flop to all-time classic because it had time to marinate and find its audience.
Okay, that makes sense, but how is The Thing the reverse Shawshank?
Because instead of starting as a forgotten gem that got rediscovered on TV, The Thing got actively rejected. Critics didn't just ignore it, they attacked it. Audiences didn't just skip it, they hated it. This wasn't a movie that needed time to find its audience. This was a movie that got thrown into a ditch and left for dead.
Jesus.
It's like if Shawshank started with the warden shooting Tim Robbins in the face and everyone in the audience was cheering.
Exactly. A reverse Shawshank.
Okay, but so what you're saying is if The Thing had been played constantly on TNT, it would have blown up sooner.
Absolutely. If The Thing had gotten the TBS dinner and a movie treatment in the 90s, it would have been a huge hit. Instead, it had to claw its way back into the culture over decades.
Yes, that's the difference. Shawshank got its redemption arc immediately once TV discovered it. The Thing had to fight its way out of the grave.
Wait, so does that mean there are other reverse Shawshanks out there?
Oh my God, I'm so glad you asked. Yes, there are.
No, no, we're not doing this.
Name them. Name the reverse Shawshanks.
Okay, off the top of my head, we will definitely get to this next week, but Big Trouble in Little China flopped in theaters, later became a cult classic. Reverse Shawshank. Blade Runner? Reverse Shawshank. The Iron Giant? Reverse. Shawshank.
Oh shit, you're right. Iron Giant is a reverse Shawshank.
This is never going to end.
And then you have the movies that almost pulled a reverse Shawshank but got saved early. Like, The Thing had to crawl for decades. But The Prestige? That movie flopped at first, then got saved by DVD and word of mouth within a few years. So it's like a mini reverse Shawshank.
Oh my God, there's tears to this.
We have to move on. This is not a movie theory podcast. We are talking about The Thing.
Excuse me, Jeff. We are talking about The Thing, because it is the ultimate reverse Shawshank.
Yeah, Jeff, this is all relevant. This is history.
It does all eventually go back to The Thing.
Both of you, go to hell. We're moving on. All right, fine. Are we done? Can we please talk about why this movie bombed?
Yes, we're done. For now.
Oh. Okay, I know we were about to move on, but I just found something on YouTube that we need to talk about. Did you guys know they made a toy commercial for The Thing?
Excuse me, what?
Like, a real kid's toy? Like G.I. Joe, but with horrifying alien body horror?
Yes, it's an actual commercial from the 80s advertising The Thing action figures.
Why would they make toys for The Thing? Who was this for?
Oh my God, I need to see this.
Okay, here it is.
No, no way. This is real.
This is one of the most messed up things I've ever seen. They made a toy where you can transform the characters into The Thing? What kid was playing with this?
It even comes with assimilating action, which sounds like a war crime.
Oh, I love this. This is like if they made Schindler's List Legos.
Do not put that energy into the world, Adam.
Ha! Oh, and did you see the tagline at the end? Who's the thing? Only you can find out. Like, this is some fun mystery game, not a movie where everyone dies horribly.
I love how they were like, yeah, the movie bombed in theaters, but kids are gonna love it.
Did they even watch the movie? The first monster literally rips open a dog and explodes into tentacles.
I like to imagine some poor grandma bought this for Christmas, thinking it was another E.T. toy.
Oh, little Timmy loves aliens. Let's get him the fun space creature toy.
Then he opens it up, and it's a horrific flesh abomination with detachable gore pieces.
Wait, wait, wait. Did they make a Wilford Brimley action figure?
Oh, please tell me there's a build-your-own-murder-shed playset.
I swear, if there was a Blair figure with axe-swinging paranoia mode, I might actually need it.
Okay, so now, the real question. If these toys were still being made today, would you buy them?
Absolutely. No hesitation. I want a full-thing playset with tiny flame effects and a blood test lab station.
And a MacReady figure that comes with a bottle of whiskey and a last stand mode.
And Childs with stare of distrust action.
The Thing toy line. It's fun for the whole family. Who's human? Who knows?
Ha ha! All right, moving on before Adam starts designing a whole thing board game.
I'm just saying, it would be incredible. You act like I'm pitching a Necromicon for kids.
I would also be interested in that. We should check eBay later.
Or right now.
I just... I don't understand how you, Steve, keep finding these absolute rabbit holes when I'm the one who actually does the research for this show.
Hey, I don't go looking for this stuff. The internet just knows what I need. It's those algorithms, baby.
Jeff spends hours deep diving into interviews and production notes. Steve types in "the thing, but stupid," and finds pure gold.
It's infuriating. I'm reading through pages of old Fangoria magazines, and meanwhile, Steve's over here like, "Hey, did you guys know The Thing had a Saturday morning cartoon pitch?"
Oh my God, do not say that, because now I have to check.
Oh.
But seriously, the fact that they tried to market The Thing, one of the most nihilistic, terrifying R-rated horror movies ever made, to children, that is some beautiful 1980s corporate logic.
It was a different time, man. Freddy Krueger had his own bubble gum.
Nothing says kid-friendly, like a burned serial killer who haunts your dreams.
I love the idea that some poor executive saw The Thing and was like, yeah, slap some neon colors on it and get it into Toys R Us. If I hits, we got to get in on the merch.
It's fine. Just don't show the part where a dude's head turns into a spider monster.
We'll sell it as a fun mystery. It's basically Clue, but with flesh mutation.
Ha ha ha. And the kids will love it.
Okay, but what are the odds there's still one of these Thing toys out there, unopened?
Please do not check eBay during the show.
Too late. I'm already invested.
Okay, so this is insane. They made a Thing toy commercial for kids for an R-rated movie.
I love how they're just casually selling The Thing like it's He-Man. Mimic your friends, assimilate your family, melt your dog, collect all the gross mutations.
I don't know, man. Something about this feels off.
What? No way. This has got to be real. I found it on YouTube. It has the grainy VHS filter and everything.
Ah, yes. The grainy VHS filter. The official stamp of credibility. Right up there with, trust me, bro.
Okay, so it's fake.
Ha ha! You got duped.
Yes! Finally! Vindication! This is why I do the research for this show.
Okay, in my defense, it looked legit. It had the old-school Kenner-style packaging, the little jingle, a stop-motion monster.
Steve, my guy, what part of we're marketing The Thing to children didn't set off an alarm in your brain?
Look, all I'm saying is, RoboCop had a cartoon. Rambo had a cartoon. Aliens had toys. Nothing makes sense.
Yeah, but The Thing is literally about paranoia, grotesque body horror, and isolation-induced madness. Like, what's the target demo for that?
Now you can reenact the horror of the Antarctic Research Station. Make MacReady burn his coworkers alive. Who's human? Who cares? Batteries not included.
Okay, but can we all admit that if this was real, we'd want one of those toys?
Oh, 100%?
Oh, yeah. I'd buy it immediately.
See? So who really won here, Jeff? Who really won?
You still lost?
I did. I really did. That sucks. Okay, but let's talk about how much this movie changed horror forever.
Oh, its fingerprints are everywhere. Look at any modern horror movie with paranoia-based tension. The Mist, It Follows, The Witch, grotesque, reality-warping body horror, The Fly, Event Horizon, Annihilation. Slow burn suspense where every scene just tightens like a noose. Hereditary, The Lighthouse.
Yeah, you watch The Thing today, and it feels way more in line with modern horror than most of its 1982 peers.
And even outside of horror, this movie bled into everything. Sci-fi, thrillers, even video games.
Oh, it's not just horror. The Thing influenced a ton of sci-fi and pop culture. The X-Files did multiple episodes that were literally just The Thing with aliens. The Hateful Eight, Tarantino straight up called it his version of The Thing. He even used the same composer, Ennio Morricone. Among Us. You cannot tell me that Game isn't just The Thing in space with little murder bean guys.
Oh, 100%. Among Us is MacReady versus Childs, but with memes.
Shh. Huh. And let's not forget, John Carpenter basically invented the Among Us kill animation.
He really did. The whole head splits open, tentacle explosion thing. Every betrayal-based game owes him royalties. And speaking of Among Us, the thing changed horror gaming forever.
Yeah, what games do you think the thing directly inspired?
Oh, let's go down the long-ass list. Resident Evil, claustrophobic slow-burn horror where you don't know who to trust. Dead Space, grotesque alien mutations taking over human bodies. The Last of Us, parasitic infection turning people into unrecognizable creatures. And The Thing, 2002 video game, a literal sequel where you play as soldiers investigating what happened at Outpost 31.
Wait, hold on. Why don't people talk about The Thing game more?
Because, just like the movie, it was ahead of its time.
So this franchise is cursed to be appreciated 20 years too late.
All right. Let's talk about one of the biggest reasons this movie has lasted for 40 plus years.
The ending.
Because no one can agree on what happens.
Exactly. MacReady and Childs just sitting there in the snow waiting to die, and the movie never tells you if one of them is infected.
It is the perfect horror ending.
Okay, so let's ask the real question. Who's the thing?
Carpenter won't say. He's left it ambiguous on purpose.
But there are clues. Some fans think Childs is the thing because he doesn't have visible breath in the cold. Some say MacReady is infected because of the whole bottle of gasoline theory. And others think they're both human, but they're just waiting to die.
See, I love that this ending still has people debating it 40 years later.
That's why it stays with you. There's no closure, and that is what makes it horror perfection. All right, final thoughts. Why has The Thing stood the test of time?
Because it's perfect paranoia horror.
Because it's practical effects done right.
Because it's a story that gets better every time you watch it.
And because we live in a world where you can't trust anybody.
That got dark.
But I'm right. That's why The Thing feels even more relevant today. It's about fear, distrust, not knowing who's on your side.
And that's why it's one of the greatest horror movies ever made. All right, next up, we're diving into the legacy of The Thing beyond the original movie.
Oh, you mean the remakes, the sequels, the prequels, and all the weird attempts to bring it back?
Wait, wasn't there a remake? Whatever it was, it came and went. What's up with that?
Oh, yeah. And we need to talk about that.
Buckle up, folks. It's about to get messy.
All right. So now we have to talk about the 2011 Thing prequel.
Oh, you mean the prequel that swore it was practical effects driven and then buried everything under terrible CGI?
I still don't understand. Why do a prequel when we already know exactly how it ends?
That's the thing. There was no mystery left to tell. The Norwegian camp was already explained in Carpenter's film. We saw the aftermath. We knew the timeline.
Yeah, but origin story?
Right. But in The Thing, the origin doesn't matter. It's about what happens once the paranoia sets in.
Exactly. But instead of doing something bold, they basically said, hey, what if we just made the same movie, but worse? And here's what makes it even worse. The 2011 prequel actually did use practical effects.
Wait, what?
Yeah, they built a ton of animatronics, prosthetics, and real handmade effects. But then at the last minute, the studio freaked out and covered everything with bad CGI.
They literally painted over practical monsters with computer-generated nonsense.
That is a crime.
It's like ordering a handcrafted brick oven pizza and then dumping microwave cheese all over it before serving it.
And the worst part? If you watch the behind-the-scenes footage, the original practical monsters looked amazing.
So they self-sabotaged.
Yep. and that's why nobody remembers this movie. All right, so now we have to talk about all the ridiculous sequel ideas Hollywood tried to push over the years.
Oh, I can feel my soul leaving my body already.
So, sequels. So let's go back to the first attempt at a sequel, a direct follow-up to Carpenter's film.
Okay, but how do you even make a sequel when the whole point of the ending is ambiguity?
Well, Universal's answer was, screw ambiguity. Let's bring back MacReady and do a big showdown.
Oh, so The Thing, round two.
Basically, the idea was that a rescue team finds MacReady, either just barely alive or already infected, and then they realize the Thing is still out there.
Okay, so is MacReady the hero again? Or is he the Thing?
See, that's where it gets messy. There were multiple drafts floating around. One, MacReady is human, and he teams up with a military squad to hunt down the Thing. Two, MacReady is the Thing, but he doesn't know it. And three, MacReady is infected, but he's trying to stop the Thing from spreading.
Oh, I love that third one.
Yeah. A horror movie where the main character is slowly realizing he's the monster? That could have been awesome.
Could have been, but Carpenter wanted nothing to do with it.
Which makes sense, because what's the first rule of the Thing?
If it ain't broke, don't touch it.
Exactly. And without Carpenter, the idea just fell apart. Universal didn't want to risk another bomb, so they scrapped it.
All right, so final verdict? Should the Thing ever come back?
I say only if Carpenter is in charge. Otherwise, let it die.
I agree. The Thing isn't just a horror movie, it's a horror experience. A sequel would just answer questions we don't need answered.
Yeah, some movies are just better left alone.
All right. Next up, let's close this out with The Thing's place in horror history.
And why it's still unmatched over 40 years later.
You know, despite how much we yelled just now, I love this damn movie.
All right, let's wrap this up by talking about The Thing's place in horror history. Because over 40 years later, it's still unmatched.
Actually, 43 years. This movie came out in 1982. That's 43 years of pure, undiluted, nightmare fuel excellence.
How dare you make time feel real right now?
We're not even quite that old, and yet somehow I feel ancient.
Look, all I'm saying is this movie has outlived entire trends in horror. It existed before found footage, before torture porn, before the elevated horror era, and yet it still feels fresh.
Yeah, like you watch The Thing today, and it feels way more in line with modern horror than most of its 1982 peers.
Exactly. It doesn't rely on cheap tricks or a gimmick. It's pure filmmaking mastery. All right, here's the thing. The Thing doesn't feel like an old movie. There's no moment where you're like, oh yeah, this is totally from the early 80s. It still looks and feels better than half the horror movies made today.
There's no 80s synth stinger followed by a dumb one-liner. No questionable haircuts. No guy in a rubber monster suit who clearly can't move his arms right.
Yeah, and there's no, oh man, look at this clunky old tech moment, because everything in the movie is just believable. You buy that this is a real research station.
Exactly. The setting? Timeless. The paranoia? Ever relevant. The effects? Still disgusting. The atmosphere? Still suffocating.
Yeah. Nothing about this movie screams, hey kids, it's the early 80s. There's no, oh wow, look at those outdated special effects moment. It's just pure dread.
You feel like you're in that research station, freezing, paranoid, looking at your coworkers like, that dude just coughed weird. Time to flamethrower him.
Okay, and here's the other thing. The Thing actually gets scarier the more you think about it.
Yes, because when you first watch it, you're just like, oh, cool, freaky alien movie. But then you rewatch it and start asking horrifying questions.
Like what?
Like, how does the thing decide who to infect? Can it control people, or does it just act on instinct? Does it remember the lives of the people it copies? Does it even know it's not the original person?
Nope. I hate that. Too much existential horror.
Welcome to The Thing. Hope you weren't planning on sleeping ever again.
Right? Because it's not just a monster movie. It's existential terror disguised as, oh no, gross dog monster. It's about losing your identity, losing your humanity. It's about the fact that at any moment, you might not be you anymore, and you wouldn't even know.
I need a break.
Oh, buddy, there are no breaks. Okay, so we've established The Thing is timeless, terrifying, and existentially horrifying, but here's what really seals the deal.
No one's ever made anything like it since.
Not even close?
Not even close. Nobody's been able to recreate what Carpenter did. People have tried, but every time they do, they get it so wrong.
What if we made The Thing, but with jump scares?
What if The Thing was just loud noises and fast cuts and a monster design you see in the first 5 minutes?
That is exactly the problem. Every modern horror movie wants to show you the monster immediately, but The Thing makes you wait. It lets your own brain make you scared before the monster even shows up.
And that's why no remake, no reboot, and no prequel can ever match it. Because Hollywood doesn't have the patience to trust the audience anymore.
So, let's sum this up. Why is The Thing still one of the greatest horror movies ever made?
Because it's timeless, because it's still terrifying, because it only gets better with age, because nothing else has ever managed to do what it did.
And because the flamethrower solution is still awesome.
You and the damn flamethrowers.
I mean, he's not wrong.
Hey, all I'm saying is if you don't know who to trust, just torch everyone.
And that's why Adam would not survive in a Thing situation.
He wouldn't even wait. Someone sneezes weird, and he's already lighting the place up.
Hey, better safe than sorry.
Best flamethrower movie?
It's either this or Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Moving on.
All right, before we move on, we need to talk about something deeply unsettling.
I swear to God, if this is about Wilford Brimley...
It is, and it's important.
Oh, hell yes. I knew this was coming.
Of course you did.
Wilford Brimley was 49 years old when he filmed The Thing.
Number. No, that's not possible.
We're doing this again. We're actually doing this again. Time is going backwards.
Oh my God. How? How did he look 65 forever?
Because Wilford Brimley was born in a rocking chair with a mustache. That's how.
Well, gentlemen, in honor of this absolute time distortion event, it's time for a game.
Wait, wait, are we doing a trivia game?
Oh, no.
Gentlemen, I give you Brimley or bullshit.
Are we just setting these up anywhere we want now? Is that what this show is? Just random games?
Ahem! Gentlemen, welcome to Brimley or Bullshit.
Oh, hell yes. This is what podcasting was made for.
This is not what podcasting was made for.
The rules are simple. I am going to read a fact about the one and only Wilford Brimley, and you two have to tell me, is it true or is it bullshit?
Let's go. I was born for this.
You were not born for this.
All right, first question. Wilford Brimley was a bodyguard for Howard Hughes.
Oh, that is 100% true. Brimley had bodyguard energy. He could just stare at a guy and make him rethink his entire life.
I don't know. That sounds like something you just made up on the spot.
True. Wilford Brimley worked security for Howard Hughes.
Fine. Next.
Wilford Brimley was part of a firing squad.
which side of the firing squad.
Wait, I've heard this. I don't know where, but I swear, I've heard this.
I don't even know what to say anymore. What is this segment? What is my life?
I'm saying true. The Brimley execution era was real.
Do you hear yourself? Brimley's execution era? That is not a thing.
Bullshit. I made that one up.
I believed in him, man. I believed.
Yeah, I'm sure Wilford Brimley appreciates your faith in his imaginary war crimes.
All right, next one. Wilford Brimley once starred in a movie where he played a younger version of himself.
What does that even mean?
How would that even work?
I'm just saying, it happened.
So you're telling me they just de-aged him in the 1980s?
Are we talking CGI de-aging, or did he just look exactly the same?
That's the mystery.
I can't handle this segment.
Is it true or not?
Bullshit. I made it up.
Okay, enough. No more Brimley facts. We have to move on.
One last one. Wilford Brimley was younger than Paul Rudd is right now when he filmed Cocoon.
No.
This is too much Cocoon talk.
True.
All right, are we done? Have you gotten this out of your system? L.
Oh, I could do this all day.
I think I need to lie down.
All right. I think we finally reached the part where we actually wrap this up. We've covered everything. The cast, the effects, the disastrous box office, the failed sequels, the Wilford Brimley war crimes.
He was never on a firing squad.
But now I want to get to the big question. Why does the thing still matter? Why has it endured for over four decades when it was buried in 1982? What makes this movie immortal?
I mean, first and foremost, it's just a flawlessly made horror film. Like, even if you take out all the deeper themes, it still works. It's scary, it's suspenseful, it's gross in all the right ways. There's not a wasted moment in this movie.
And that's what gets me. There's nothing in here that feels dated. I watch a lot of older horror, and you can usually feel the era it came from. But The Thing, you could release this today and people would still lose their minds.
Right, and I think a lot of that comes down to two things. The effects and the paranoia.
Yes, the effects are still absolutely untouchable. Like, if this was made today, it would be a CGI nightmare. And we'd all complain about how it looks like a video game cutscene.
The Thing 2011, never forget.
But the paranoia, that's what makes this movie timeless. It's not just, oh no, there's a monster. It's, oh no, I have no idea who I can trust. That is universal. That is evergreen. And that's why this movie just gets better as time goes on.
And that's what makes it scarier than most horror movies. Because when you boil it down, The Thing isn't just about an alien monster. It's about the fear of the unknown. The fear that the people closest to you might not be who you think they are.
Yeah, it's not guy in a mask chases you with a knife. It's the people around you might already be against you. And you won't know until it's too late. That's existential terror. That's real fear.
And that's why it hits even harder now. In a world where nobody trusts anyone, where misinformation is everywhere, where people question what's real all the time, this movie feels more relevant today than it did in 1982.
Yeah, watching this in 2025 hits way different. Every time someone says, I'm not the thing, I'm just sitting there like, I've heard that before.
Wait.
All right, last thing before we go, I want to know. What does this movie mean to you? Why is it one of the greats for you personally?
For me, this is the paranoia movie. There's nothing else like it. The way it builds tension, the way it makes you question every single person in every single scene. It's perfect. It's the kind of movie that gets under your skin and just lives there. And honestly, it's one of the best examples of what horror can really do when it's at its best.
Yeah, for me, It's the ultimate there is no hope movie. Like, most horror movies give you some way out, right? Some way to fight back, some chance for survival. But The Thing? This movie just tells you, no, you are screwed. And I love that.
You would. That tracks for you.
I love horror movies that don't give you an easy answer. And The Thing, no answers, no hope, no way out. Just sit in the snow and wait to die. It's bleak as hell, but that's why it sticks with you.
For me, this is John Carpenter's masterpiece. I know people will say Halloween or Escape from New York, and those are legendary. But The Thing, this is the best thing he's ever done. It's got his signature style, it's got his perfect pacing, it's got his cold, cynical worldview. This is the Carpenter movie.
If someone had never seen a Carpenter movie before, is this the one you'd tell them to start with?
Honestly, yes. It's everything that makes him great. The tension, the minimalism, the insanely good cinematography, the morally gray characters, it's all here. If you want to understand why John Carpenter is a legend, watch The Thing.
Man, what a film.
43 years later, and we're still talking about it like it just came out.
Because The Thing is forever. No matter how many remakes they try, no matter how much they fail to recapture it, this movie will always be the best. Always.
To The Thing, the greatest snow movie that is not Empire Strikes Back.
I was really hoping we could get out of here without going back to that.
Never long live Hoth.
Hey, at least we can all agree on The Thing.
Yeah, that's the one thing we can trust. All right, that's The Thing, one of the greatest horror films ever made, one of the greatest horror experiences ever crafted, a masterclass in tension, paranoia, and practical effects. And 43 years later, still as terrifying as the day it flopped at the box office.
I love how we just keep reminding people that this movie failed when it came out. Like, yeah, it's a perfect film, but also, audiences in 1982 were cowards.
Look, when you have the choice between a movie where a cuddly alien eats Reese's Pieces and a movie where a guy's chest turns into a mouth and eats his doctor, I kind of get it.
The Thing's legacy is undeniable. It started out as a flop, but now it's one of the greatest horror movies ever. Meanwhile, no one even knows who the kid in E.T. is.
Wait, wasn't that Drew Barrymore?
No, she was the little sister. The main kid was,
Oh, right. Hold on. Wait, was it Macaulay Culkin?
No, not even close.
Dude, E.T. came out in 1982. Macaulay Culkin was still in preschool, not biking around with aliens.
Okay, so who was it?
Henry Thomas.
Who?
Oh my God, he's literally Elliot, the kid from E.T.
I mean, yeah, but who else was he?
Are you serious? Henry Thomas is great. He was in Dr. Sleep, Haunting of Hill House, Legends of the Fall.
A Hallmark movie every Christmas.
Okay, but was he in Cocoon?
What? No, why would he... Why are you back on Cocoon?
I don't know. Look, I know E.T. is a classic, but The Thing is just way more my vibe.
Same. And let's be honest, if E.T. had a flamethrower, it would have been a much better movie.
All right, moving on.
All right, so we did it. We actually made it through The Thing without... Oh God, we forgot to rank Kurt Russell's beard.
We did!
No, we're not doing this. We're not circling back just to argue about the beard.
Where does it rank?
Look, it's top tier, but is it better than his Hateful Eight beard? Or does it land right below the Tombstone mustache?
You put it below the Tombstone mustache?
Oh my God.
Look, that mustache could lead men into battle, but the Thing beard? That's a survivalist beard. It's the beard of a man who's accepted that he might have to commit arson at any moment.
Yeah. Yeah, okay, that tracks.
Why are we doing this after the episode? You had all that time to bring this up.
Ha ha! Hey, we were busy. There were Wilford Brimley conspiracy theories to discuss.
And at least we didn't forget to play Wilford Brimley Man or Myth.
Please, I am begging you both. Let it go.
Hey, next episode, let's rank best Kurt Russell hair. Because let's be real.
He has never had bad hair.
I'm leaving. Today's show is now done.
Also, I caught Tombstone on cable the other day because my parents still have cable. And you know what? That movie still rules.
Oh, we're doing it. We're doing a Tombstone episode. It's happening.
We are not doing a Tombstone episode just because Steve's parents refused to cancel Comcast.
Listen, you know we have to. Val Kilmer absolutely owned that movie.
That's right, folks. Coming soon, Rewind or Die presents Tombstone.
No. You can't just announce new episodes like that.
And you know we have to talk about the real Wyatt Earp movie drama.
Ooh, the dueling Tombstone versus Wyatt Earp. Dueling Earps. Oh, it's happening.
I hate everything about this.
All right, folks. Until next time. If you find a weird spaceship buried under the ice, just leave it alone.
Yeah, or at least do the blood test before you invite it into your camp.
All right. Let's go. Oh, we spent all day on this.
Tombstone.
You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.
Producer Steve hopes you have enjoyed this program.